from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, a discussion all about Title IX. We'll look at its history as well as ongoing questions related to monitoring and enforcement and controversies and battles over high school and collegiate sports and gender equity. Forum is next with the panel and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Title IX is the federal law that prohibits sex discrimination in educational institutions. The law states that, quote, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance, end quote. Though the legislation covers all educational activities and complaints, and nothing in the law specifically mentions athletics, the effect of Title IX has largely been on high school and collegiate athletic programs. Much controversy and ongoing battles persist over questions of gender equity in sports stemming from the impact of Title IX. This Saturday, Stanford University's Center on Ethics is hosting a day-long conference called Title IX Today, Title IX Tomorrow, followed by an Aurora Forum in Maples Pavilion featuring Billie Jean King and entitled Title IX at 35. In this forum hour, we focus our attention on Title IX. We have a whole panel, but before we go to our panel, we wanted to talk with Brandi Chastain, the 96 Olympic gold medalist and 91 and 99 Women's Soccer World Cup champion, and she joins us from down in the South Bay this morning. Good morning, Brandi Chastain.
Good morning to you as well. Thank you very much for having me.
Glad to have you here. Is it Brandi or is it Hollywood? Where do you go, Brandi?
You've been talking to Julie Foudy again. Brandi, please.
Well, let's talk about Title IX from your perspective. I mean, when you look back on your career, when you look back on all the extraordinary things you've done in sports, a lot of contribution as far as Title IX legislation from your perspective?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the foundation for my career was based on Title IX. Having people like Billie Jean King as role models who've helped me understand that, you know, there is a place for all of us to participate and to play. And without this law, perhaps I'm wouldn't have had an opportunity to afford a university education. And so, of course, the answer is yes. It has clearly impacted my career.
And I have to ask you, because we're going to be talking, among other things, about the still low numbers of women who are in coaching and all of that. And your husband's a women's coach, or women's soccer coach, I believe.
That's correct.
So, I mean, to some extent, I have to ask you, since we're raising this whole question of gender equity, when there are so few women soccer coaches who are women, what about your husband?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that I would like to see a greater number of women participate in the coaching. I have to say, actually, my sister-in-law, who was my husband's assistant coach at Santa Clara University, just took a head coaching job at DePaul University in Chicago. So I think it's gaining. I think it's gaining employees, you know, coaches, and I think it's one of those things that, like women in professional sports, there's been a slow time process to get people involved, and I think that's why it's important to have professional women's sports that young girls can go to, because they're not only going to be the players on the field, but they'll be the general managers, maybe they'll be the legal counsel, maybe they'll be the athletic trainer, and perhaps even the coach. But if they don't have those things around to see on a regular basis, then it kind of seems out of touch. It's not real. It doesn't happen. And so it is slow. Would I like to see more women coaching? Absolutely. I myself have thought just long and hard about this very recently, thinking, you know, I need to get back into coaching. But you're right. We need to see more women coaching women or coaching men. I don't see why women couldn't coach men. You know, the games are X's and O's, and about physical fitness and challenging and competition. I don't see how that separates us because of our gender.
But you're optimistic about movement forward, despite your characterizing it as slow, I mean, on all fronts.
Yes, absolutely. We've gone in the right direction. I think you can look over time. I mean, when I began playing soccer at the collegiate level, I believe there were 75 Division I programs. The majority of them were not fully funded programs like they are today, and now we have over 320 Division I programs with scholarship opportunity for young women across this country. So I would say that we're going in the right direction.
Brandi Chastain, again, is 96 Olympic gold medalist and 91 and 99 women's soccer world champion, and we all remember that moment and cherish it, as I'm sure you do, that glorious moment of yours, and we've had a wonderful couple moments with you here, and I appreciate very much your being with us.
It's my pleasure, really.
And we're going to talk with some other people about Title IX. In fact, we're going to look at its history and look at what progress has been made, as well as what sort of the continuing debates are and what is moving forward. Welt Suggs, in fact, has written a whole book about Title IX. It's called The Triumph and Tragedy of Title IX, A Place on the Team is the title. And he joins us this morning from Athens, Georgia. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Good to have you with us. And also with us is Myra Strober, who's professor of education at Stanford. Welcome, Myra Strober.
Thank you.
And Deborah Rohde, who is Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law at Stanford University, author of Speaking of Sex, The Denial of Gender Inequality. Good morning, Deborah Rohde.
Good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to Ann Killian, who is a sports columnist with the San Jose Mercury News.
Good morning.
Ann Killian, what still needs to be done from your perspective, the overall picture?
I think the thing that I sense right now is that there needs to be kind of a refocusing, more energy. I feel that I look back 10 years ago and it seemed like the movement behind women's sports really was at its peak after the 96 Olympics and the 99 World Cup. And, you know, the future seemed so bright and the possibilities seemed so open. And I think that there's been a little bit of a tapering off of that whole movement.
Sort of like the year of the woman in politics or something?
Absolutely. It was kind of the 3 years of the woman in sports, and that, you know, it launched a couple of professional leagues, and it just seemed that things had changed. And I sense now that there isn't as much energy. Obviously, some of this has to do with the Bush administration kind of working behind the scenes to weaken Title IX. But I think some of it is, you know, Brandi just said, this was the foundation of my career. Well, I don't think a lot of the women athletes today understand that. My sense is from younger women athletes that they take it for granted, and they don't understand that this is something that's a relatively new phenomenon, that they get to do this, that they get to play sports and have equality. And I think there just needs to be more vigilance and more watchdogging and more energy behind the movement.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the monitoring and public policy sides of this, as well as the legal sides. But I want to sort of look back at the history. And, Welt Suggs, let's do that with you. I mean, originally, although this has now become so identified with sports, it was sort of rooted in civil rights, and it was rooted specifically in an Equal Opportunity in Education Act, which doesn't only cover sports. In fact, as I said in my introduction, sports wasn't even in the language.
Oh, that's right. Actually, it was specifically excluded because the folks who were pushing the legislation did not want to raise the controversy or the specter of sports in a debate over Title IX in Congress.
And Patsy Mink is the figure here? I mean, just to give the historical personage the right name?
It is. I think actually Title IX is now named the Patsy Mink Title IX law. She was one of the early sponsors, along with Edith Green, Representative Edith Green from Tennessee, as well as Senator Birch Bayh from Indiana was the sponsor on the Senate side.
And when you talk about, as your title suggests, the triumph and tragedy, what do you see as the triumph? What do you see as the tragedy of Title IX?
Well, what I really see as the triumph is what we've been discussing and what Brandi discussed in the dramatic throwing open of the gym doors to women all over the country and at all levels of high school and college sports. The tragedy of Title IX, I see, is the fact that women have been participating in sports for over a century at the college and high school levels. But up until about 1980, they had their own leagues, their own system, and it was all very rooted in education. It was all run by physical education departments at colleges and universities. And what we've seen over the years is as the NCAA has taken over women's sports, they've imposed their own model of how to do sports that has grown up with the men's side, which is heavily commercial and heavily regulated. And in many cases, you find it very troubling that the deep ties between education and athletics seem to be lost. And I think we're seeing those trends creeping into women's sports as well as men's.
So you have all these commercial and recruiting pressures. You also have all the complaints that are often leveled at Title IX for wrestling and cross country for men and these kinds of fencing, these kinds of sports sort of going by the wayside.
That has been a huge issue, of course. And I tend not to think of that as the national tragedy, although it's certainly the tragedy for any male athlete or female athlete when their sports are cut. Michael, I believe you went to Ohio University as an undergrad. Is that right?
Correct.
Well, Ohio just this year dropped men's track, cross-country, swimming, and women's lacrosse as well. And when you start seeing colleges like Ohio or Rutgers or James Madison dropping both men's and women's sports, you have to think, is this because of gender equity or is this because of budget pressures? And when you see the increasing cost of putting on the men's showtime sports of football and men's basketball, then the debate becomes a little more complicated.
Well, let's bring Myra Strober into this debate. She's professor of education at Stanford and has certainly taken some serious look at this as a scholar and as a professor. The critics say less money spent on minor sports or what we're seeing is other sports with men disappearing as a result. What do you think?
Well, there is a huge debate about gender equity and what it means for men's sports. I think we have to keep things in perspective and note that even though more money is now being spent on women's sports than it was before, it's still the case, for example, that women coaches don't get the same amount of money as men coaches, despite the fact that they're coaching the same sport. The recruiting budgets for women's sports are often not equal to those of men's sports. And so there is still an ongoing question about the funding for women's sports.
So, so the reality that there seems to be more interest in male sports, although certainly the interest in women's sports has increased in quantum proportions, but how to equalize, especially when you have the problem or the challenge, I should say, of women, well, having to deal with families?
Well, women having to do with family is a difficulty for women coaches sometimes. And it's interesting.
I was thinking specifically about the coaches, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about Brandy's husband being a man who coaches women's soccer. I think, ironically, as the pay for women's sports coaching does increase, more and more men are attracted to it. So that this is the same in all occupations. As salaries go up, men are attracted to those occupations. And so I think that's part of the explanation for why men have come into women's coaching. But, you know, as more women are involved in sports, then they grow up and their families are interested in women's sports. And so I think over time, we're going to get an increase in interest and TV revenues and so on. My husband says that he loves to go to Stanford women's basketball games because the women are shorter than the men are on average. And so it's not as easy to get the ball in the basket, and the sport looks more interesting to him. And I think as more men begin to get excited about women's sports, we will see a change in the revenues from games and from television.
We've also seen male collegiate sports participation actually increasing since Title IX, but a lot of that has to do with male enrollment, of course, rising, and the number of men's sports per male student has actually declined. Just a fact that I'm curious to get your response to, Professor Strober.
It's hard to know why that's the case. You know, it's hard to know whether the men who are going to college now proportionally have more responsibilities in terms of earning a living and can't be as interested in sports. Some of it has to do with the difficulty of finding jobs and men being more interested in being totally immersed in their studies. So it's just really hard to know why.
Again, Myra Strober is professor of education at Stanford. Deborah Rohde is Ernest W. McFarland, professor of law at Stanford and author of Speaking of Sex, the Denial of Gender Inequality, which is published by Harvard Press. Deborah Rohde, help us understand how monitoring and vigilance works with respect to Title IX. I know there's been a lot of resistance to legal challenges right from the start, beginning back in 1972. But it's Office of Civil Rights through U.S. Department of Education, isn't it?
It is, and there's a lot of criticism about the inadequacy of enforcement and the insufficiency of penalties. The main sanction for Title IX noncompliance is a funding cutoff, and it's a cutoff of all federal funds, and it's never been used. There are a lot of questions about how to make compliance effective. And to put it in a bit of perspective, you still see continuing inequalities for women, despite the dramatic improvement since Title IX. 55% of college graduates are now women, but they're only 41% of the athletes, and 37% of the program expenditures go to women's sports. Still, there's an enormous improvement since enactment of the statute. The numbers alone tell the story. From 290,000 high school participants pre-Title IX to 2.9 million today, 16,000 college athletes, women college athletes, to 180,000. That's a 1,000% increase. But one of the ironic byproducts, as people have noted, is that with the increasing attractiveness of women's sports, there's been increasing competition for the coaching positions. And while it used to be pre-Title IX that 90% of women's teams were coached by women, now it's only 40%, and women continue to coach only 2% of men's teams. And that's not for lack of interest. It's because, as my own recent survey of coaches indicated, 90% of the respondents thought that men preferred male coaches, and a large percentage thought they wouldn't accept women. But one other historical point I think is really critical here. There's a lot not to like in the history of women's sports, and in the early part of its development, there was worry about unsexed Amazons acquiring an indelicate sweat. And when I played varsity tennis for Yale, and just as Title IX was being enacted, we had no locker facilities, no budget, a local PE teacher who came to the matches and brought iced tea and said, good shot occasionally. You know, there's been an enormous transformation in that. But what's been lost is, I think Welch Suggs pointed out, is a kind of ethic of participation. The adage used to be a girl for every sport and a sport for every girl. And we're still a long way from achieving that promise. And since many institutions have financed women's increased participation by cuts in male budgets and expenditures, Title IX has become a scapegoat for a lot of unhappiness about the loss of male athletic opportunities, and that gets in the way of gender equity as well.
Yet there's been a lot of achievement with Title IX. I'm looking at some facts here from a paper that was put out. It talks about lowering dropout rate, increasing opportunities for women in math and science, increasing completion of post-secondary, graduate, and professional degrees. In other words, lots of things that we don't associate with athletics.
All the studies show that women benefit from participation in high school and college sports in all sorts of ways. Reduction of eating disorders, lower stress, and, you know, all the indices of mental health, as well as the physical benefits.
What are you seeing, Ann Killian? I mean, you've been covering this beat for a while. You said it kind of flattened out, but in terms of benefits overall?
Oh, well, I think any of us who are around athletes at the college and high school level, or who have our own children, know the benefits of sports, both for boys and girls. And I think that's why there is this strong movement. When Ted Leland, the former athletic director at Stanford, was on the Title IX commission for the Bush administration, looking into how the law could be changed, or if it needed to be changed, he told me that he discovered that it is one of our country's most popular laws, that there's this large groundswell of support for it. Because I think people see the benefit of sport, and all it takes is some dads to have daughters for them to come around and see the benefit of being involved in athletics. And I do think that it's true that the women's sports can't be held to the same paradigm as men's, and that is a difficulty. I just witnessed it at the NCAA tournament, which was being held at Stanford, where they're trying to impose the men's tournament on top of the women's game, and they they don't have, they should be giving away the tickets. They shouldn't be charging the same prices that they charge for the men's. They need to get little girls into the building, and yet the NCAA still operates. You know, they do try and make everyone fit into the same form, which I think is too bad. But I think, I mean, there's no question that there's been tremendous progress, significant progress, and that the benefits are, you know, you can't ever begin to say that there's no benefit or even that there's no interest. I mean, I think that's a false argument to say that you know, well, there's more interest in men's sports. We're seeing that change. I mean, as our daughters grow up, assuming that they can play sports, the interest is there. With opportunity comes the interest.
There's still the institutionalized and cultural sexism, though, that one has to concede here. No, I mean, in fact, you were saying before we went on the air that we learned a good deal about that when Don Imus went on with his statements about the Rutgers basketball team.
Right. And that was very disheartening for those of us who've, you know, been advocates of women's athletics over the last 20 years or so, to see that probably women's sports got more attention in the last 2 weeks than it has since perhaps the 1999 World Cup. And it's all because of Don Imus's remarks. And while there was an outcry over that, I've got to say he's not alone in the way he talked about those women athletes. I find it in mainstream sports. I find, you know, if you listen to any kind of sports talk radio, you hear very similar commentary about women athletes. They're still marginalized. They're still judged on their appearance more than men are, far more than men are. They're still not taken as seriously. I mean, In the world of mainstream sports, there's still quite a battle to be fought there.
A lot of the battle, again, gets back to compliance. Welsh Suggs, there's this three-prong compliance, and critics say it operates almost as a quota. Can you give us some illumination on that?
I will do my best in the nutshell version anyway. It's interesting. I mean, Title IX guidelines go on for pages and pages and cover things like, you know, making sure that men and women have the equitable tutoring situations and practice times and facilities and so forth. But the thing that has drawn the most attention has been this question of participation, of how do you certify that you have enough female athletes on your teams to be in compliance. And basically the three-part test says that to certify yourself, you have to prove that you are meeting one of three tests. The first test is that you have the same proportion of female athletes on teams as you have female undergraduates in your student body. So if your student body is 55-45 female-male, which, as Deb Rohde said, is pretty typical these days, or actually a little on the low side, then you're supposed to have a 55-45 split between female athletes and male athletes. The second part of the test is to be able to demonstrate that you have a history and continuing practice of expanding opportunities for female athletes. So if you have been expanding teams or adding teams or other things in recent years, you can demonstrate that you're in compliance that way. And then the third test, which we may come back to, I suspect, is to be able to prove that you are fully and effectively accommodating the interests and abilities of female students as regards athletics.
And there's also a policy clarification now that's up before us. But let me do this because the time is before us as well. Thank you for that lucid description of the three-prong compliance. I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. You may have some thoughts about Title IX. You may have questions or comments. If so, by all means, feel free to call us now. At our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us. The email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Title IX, and there is an event going on at Stanford that I wanted to highlight again, talking about the fact that this is going on while the NFL draft is going on. We're talking with Ann Killian about that off air, and also that the anniversary of Title IX is in June rather than in April. But Billie Jean King is going to be there, and so are a number of the people that we're talking with today. And it's an important conference that will again be held at Stanford this Saturday, April 28th, a one-day conference. I'm looking at a cartoon here also with a college football guy dressed in this with a helmet and everything else. This is from Deborah Rohde's PowerPoints, sitting on a huge bag of obviously money. He's got a dollar sign on it, and he's and there's a kid with a tennis racket holding a bag that says discontinued men's sports going to a locker room, like kind of closing down, and the huge money bag, which is has on top of it the college football player, says it's Title IX's fault that this kid is. Deborah Rohde kind of says some of it to you, doesn't she?
Well, yes, and, you know, I direct Stanford Center on Ethics, and we are the sponsors of the Title IX Symposium. Anyone who wants information, it's Stanford Ethics. We have a website, and we're co-sponsoring the event in the evening with Billie Jean King. And the point of that really is, I think, to draw attention to the gender equity challenges and controversies that still remain. As you noted earlier, there's an enormous amount of complacency out there and quite, I think, still a bit of public misperception about the role of Title IX in the decrease in men's non-revenue sports. And it's, you know, it is definitely the case that the pressures on higher education to equalize opportunities for women have, in some instances, meant decreasing opportunities for men. There are two ways to get into compliance with Title IX. One is to add more resources for women's programs, the equalizing up strategy, and the other one is to decrease the amount of money that's available for men. And what a lot of institutions that face other demands on their resources have done is cut back in the non-revenue producing men's sports. So, you know, wrestling and golf, for example, while football continues to eat up a huge amount of the resources available for male sports.
And of course, the argument is it brings in a lot of money, too, right?
Well, it does, but it's really contested how profitable football is for most institutions. And the Women's Sports Foundation, which I think has done the most careful survey, has found that in four-fifths of higher educational institutions, 81% of the football teams run at a deficit. And the reason why they continue to get the support is because they're very popular with students, alums, the community, and state legislatures. And so nobody wants to kill what's at least in part a cash cow, but more importantly, something that to the reputation and morale and builds alumni support and so forth.
We're getting some crosstalk here, and I'm not even sure why. I think it has to do with the ISDN at Stanford. If we can choke it, let's do that by all means. I also wanted to remind listeners, by the way, that we are going to take your phone calls, and if you'd like to join us, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or satellite, Sirius satellite, that is, you can join us now at 866-733-6786 in this ongoing discussion about Title IX, and also can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. I'm sorry, Deborah Rohde, did you finish what you were saying there? Because I heard that crosstalk and it threw me for a minute.
Yeah, I heard it as well. I do want to say that there's a bit of demonization of college football that's unfair here. I mean, 40% of NCAA schools don't have football teams, and the reason why you still see the difficulties at those institutions has to do with, you know, real budget constraints, and athletics competes with other needs, scholarships, increasing information technology costs, healthcare, and so forth that are spiraling, and so there's a real question about how you you create adequate opportunities for women that haven't been there in the past, without dramatically cutting into the resources that are available for other equally important and urgent educational needs.
So does this, Myra Strober, kind of boil down to, you know, we've got so many on this side and we've got so many on that side and we have to have equal numbers?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about so far is the importance for women of participating in sports so that later in their careers they have experience participating in teams. And a lot of the literature on management and women in management suggests that the experience of participating on teams is very useful for management, the skills that one learns of being a team member and so on. And so I think that it is important to equalize the opportunity for women and men to participate in sports. That said, I think we tend to have a rather narrow view of what sports is. And my daughter, who is an anthropologist at Seattle University, Liz Strober, is making a documentary right now on Native Hawaiian women surfers. And what she has learned is that women in Hawaii have been surfing for more than 1,000 years. So if we think about the history of women in sports, it goes back quite a long time. And often these women surf together and are part of a team, but not a competitive team. And their purpose is to be part of the environment and feel that they are part of the ocean, and they find it a healing experience. And so I think when Anne talks about the possible differences in the way that we see men's and women's sports, I think we do have to broaden our vision about what role athletics can play in the lives of women.
And let me go to our callers. And Laura, you're first up here. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Hi. I'm a documentary producer-director, and I did the film Red Rain, which features Gina Guidi. She's a professional boxer. And listening to this, specifically boxing, what happens with the women is that they're not given an amateur period. They're given, where the men are given an amateur period to develop, have lots of fights. And when women started boxing, they just trained them for a very short time and threw them into the professional world. So they were set up to fail. And I think possibly this is just in the boxing world, because I was in the boxing world when I made this film for two or three years. And I think with the fact that they didn't have this amateur period, they were set up to fail. And then, of course, when they get into the professional ring, they weren't taken seriously. They were judged on their looks and if they were sexy and if they were pretty. But the skill hadn't had time to develop their skills. So, of course, they weren't at the level of men. Now, that was 1999, and I think it's changed a bit. So that's my comment about the boxing world.
Well, we thank you for that comment. Good to hear from someone's actually made a film about women boxers. But what about the point, Ann Killian, that maybe women are thrown in a little bit, even though there's all that anthropological evidence that goes way back, that they don't have the training in many instances, or haven't, even in the wake of Title IX?
Well, I think that probably hurt women early on, that you know, they were given sports and there wasn't a lot of there weren't sports that they'd been grown up playing. And I think that that's starting to change too. I think that, you know, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and she can basically, she has anything available to her that she wants, which is far different than it was when I was 12 years old. And so I think that just as boys always have, women are, young girls are finding what they love, finding what they're best at, and getting the correct training and getting the support at a young age. And some people think that that's too much, you know, with the craze in youth sports. That's a whole different topic, that we put too much emphasis on it for our kids. But I do think there are a lot of opportunities out there for girls to find the sport that they excel at and that they enjoy.
Ann Killian, again, is a sports columnist with the San Jose Mercury News, and our next caller is Ken. Ken, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering whether your guests had an opinion as to whether there are blue states and red states as regards Title IX and women's sports. I'm from the Northeast, and I can tell you that the year that both the men and the women's basketball teams at UConn won national championships in the same year, I mean, you couldn't find people that didn't have equal support for both programs. And I'll tell you, the best hockey game in town still is the University of New Hampshire women's game. And I'm wondering whether or not in the Northeast here, in the blue states, we have a much more support for women's sports than other areas of the country.
You notice regional differences down there from your perspective in Arkansas, Welch Suggs?
Well, I'm actually at the University of Georgia, so.
I mean, excuse me, University of Georgia.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually would say it's not so much red and blue states, but it's certainly regions. Here at UGA, we have a fantastic women's gymnastics team that's competing in the national championships this weekend. And their games are happening. They're major events here in town. And, no, they're not talked about in the same way as football, which gets 92,000 people a game. But still, it's a huge deal. Same with women's soccer.
You've also got the Augusta Golf Club down there still, don't you?
Yes, we do. Yeah, so golf is kind of popular in these parts. But it's interesting that you find enclaves, especially at the high school level, like Hart County, Georgia, or Shelbyville, Tennessee, or places like that, where the entire town goes nuts over high school girls' basketball, and it far outshines the men's game. The same is true at the University of Tennessee. Now, it's interesting because I don't think you find that on a statewide basis, but what you find is that women's teams can build these tremendous communities of fans and supporters within a given area, within a given niche.
And on we go to more of our callers. We go to Ann next. Good morning, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. This is just a wonderful show that I'm just thrilled you're having. I tried to think of just two comments to keep my comments short so everybody can get on, but it brings up a lot for me. I played basketball and volleyball at Mills College in Oakland, which is an all-women's college, which had the benefit of not competing for men's attention, between men and women's attention. And it was a really amazing experience in that we basically got all the funding, which still wasn't much for a Division III school, but we got all the attention, and there wasn't a competition of, you know, does the men's basketball team or the women's basketball team get more money? And I think that makes a big difference because you're not, there's no kind of judgment in terms of equality of the sport. And also, I think what that the other part of that that I'd like to say in my experience is that one of the big problems I think with women's sports and how it's treated is homophobia. I think that, you know, there's a lot of fear of, you know, our daughters are going to become lesbians if they play sports. And I think until that's addressed, people aren't going to really, you know, support women's sports. I think it's a huge issue that's really not talked about enough. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you for your call. And Myra Strober, actually, in some of the reading material, homophobia does come up time and again. Can we get a comment from you on it?
Well, I think that's true. It does come up. I think there are many images of women in sports and their stereotypes, and they're contradictory. So, for example, going back to surfing, despite the fact that Native Hawaiian women are surfers, the image that most of us have of surfers are from the Beach Boys notion of blonde, very thin women, which certainly doesn't match the Native Hawaiian women surfers. And then we have images of women in sports as being lesbians, which is sometimes true and sometimes not. So I think we have to broaden our notion of who participates in sports and realize that it's a very popular thing for many kinds of people.
Myra Strober, again, is professor of education at Stanford, and Deborah Rohde is Edward McFarland professor of law at Stanford and the author of Speaking of Sex. And Deborah Rohde, I want to get back to enforcement before we go to some more calls here. And a lot of the points that you have made in this presentation of yours, I'm looking again at this PowerPoint presentation, are things which really suggest the necessity of some serious tightening up and just better work where compliance is concerned. You've got lack of independent monitoring, insufficient penalties for noncompliance, inequalities in program support and salaries, inadequacy of legal remedies. In other words, it's a kind of laundry list of things that need to be done and need to be sharpened up.
Right. Well, it's estimated that probably about 80% of all colleges and universities are out of compliance with Title IX under the three-prong test that Welch described earlier. And that speaks to a lack of enforcement resources, but also I think the political opposition that would be generated if a lot of pressure were really placed on institutions to equalize opportunities, and more would have to face the difficult question of priorities and how you allocate between the male sports that still have higher visibility and build institutional reputation to a greater extent than women. I mean, that's changing. Certainly, when I participated in sports as a kid, we got gym classes in hula hooping and ring toss. I mean, you know, now no one would let that kind of inequality pass muster. But there's still, I think, a willingness to tolerate a substantial amount of gender equities, and it goes all the way down. It affects salaries. Women coaches of women's teams, you know, get about half of what coaches of men's teams do. And the law really hasn't been, I think, sufficiently effective in giving a flexible enough compliance and oversight structure to deal with some of the continuing inequalities.
Well, as long as we're talking about the law for a moment, let me go back to Welch Suggs, who is, again, the author of A Place on the Team, The Triumph and Tragedy of Title IX. What is this policy clarification that we're now seeing going on?
It's been, honestly, I don't think any of us can say whether it's truly had an effect yet. But in essence, what it has done is clarify how schools can comply with the third part of the three-part test, the part about demonstrating interest and ability for female students. And what is problematic about it is that it indicates that colleges can administer a survey and to do so fairly casually, just by putting a survey on a website or telling students they can fill this out if they want or whatever, and that then they can assess whether students who respond say, yes, they're interested in sports or no, they're not. But also if they don't respond, that non-responses can be interpreted as lack of interest. So if you have a survey that gets a response rate of 20% and you presume that the other 80% just don't care, then you can find yourself in compliance. Again, I don't know how widely this is being used, partly because it has been so controversial. The NCAA and other organizations have called on schools not to use this instrument. And I, as I said, I'm just not aware if any schools are trying to use that prong these days in that sense to demonstrate compliance.
And Killian, you're going to say something here?
Well, that was just one of the most bizarre things that has been issued by you know, under the Bush administration, of how to judge interests by an email. And I mean, all of us who know how many emails we get, that would be the standard. And correct me if I'm wrong, but men did not have to issue their own. They did not have to say their interest. This was only for women. So men's interest was assumed and women were having to dig through their email inboxes to find the right thing to fill out to show their interest. But as he said, the NCAA thinks it's a bogus standard, too.
I'm sorry.
It's Deborah Rohde. To be fair about this, I mean, the office did put out a kind of standardized methodology to try to correct for some of the obvious biases. And we don't know yet whether they're going to be serious in terms of saying that unless you conduct the survey in a rigorous way and get a decent participation rate, it's not going to count in measuring compliance. But I think the real problem with that method of assessing gender equity goes much deeper. It used to be said in the 1970s before Title IX was passed, well, of course, the reason why you have all these disparities is because women just aren't interested. And the history of this legislation shows that when opportunities that are well-financed and have some level of status and offer opportunities for real athletic development are there, women take advantage of them. So it's a self-reinforcing cycle. And you really don't know how much interest there is until you create opportunities.
Shannon, join us. You're on forum. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a judo player, and I'm a father of two girls, and I also teach judo at the community center here in Petaluma. And in my class, I teach equal amount of girls and boys. In judo in general, we practice integratively. I'm just wondering why there hasn't been any speak of grading teams, and if that's an absolutely absurd notion to many, it's not to me, but I'd like to hear your comments.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Shannon. Why there hasn't been any speech of what?
Integrating sports with and women practicing together or on the same teams, even.
Myra Strober?
This is certainly not my field of expertise, but I would agree with the caller, and I would say that this is something that should be tried, and where men and women, girls and boys want to play on the same team, they should be permitted to do that. I think some of the problem has been, again, back to stereotypes and the notion, as your caller suggests, that women and men, girls and boys, can't possibly play on the same teams.
Well, it's kind of hard to think of women in the gridiron, even though there are some who have wanted to be there, you know. You want to weigh in here, Ann Killian?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at a young age, at 5, 6, 7, 8, co-ed teams do exist, and happily so, you know, soccer and basketball and other sports. But, I mean, I think to suggest that men and women should play on the same team, it again creates this kind of false argument. It's, you know, Billie Jean King was great when she beat Bobby Riggs, but women don't have to prove themselves by, you know, competing one-on-one with men. And let's be honest, boys at around 13, 14, 15, you know, get significantly bigger, stronger. They change, you know, men and women, young men and women end up having vastly different body types. So integrating at a higher level, I just don't think works. It would be unfair to women.
Integrating may not be a 50-50 team, but it may be that there are one or two women or one or two men who would like to play on a team that is not the majority of their gender, and it doesn't seem to me that there would be any reason why that should
and that does happen.
Be prohibited.
If you have a woman who can be a lineman and hold her own, why not have her there?
And certainly
that make sense?
Yeah. That's happening in high schools. There's women on young women on baseball teams and football teams. But, you know, women like Brandi Chastain grew up having to play on men's teams. There were no boys' no girls' teams for young women soccer players back in her day. So I think, you know, I think we wouldn't want to turn back the clock to that.
There's actually quite a debate about whether you want separate but equal in high school sports, especially, particularly where, for example, not all the same sports are available to members of each sex. So if there isn't a comparable girls' team, should the boys get to play on the girls' team or vice versa? And what do you do with the exceptional athlete? And it's actually a trade-off because on the one hand, letting the girl outstanding soccer player play with the boys means that her professional development will be enhanced, but it deprives the girls' team of the kind of person who can lead them to the championship and can bring others along the way. So there are real trade-offs involved.
Again, Deborah Rohde is the author of Speaking of Sex, A Denial of Gender Equality, and Edward McFarland, professor of law at Stanford. I'm looking at some of your emails here. Linda writes, I wonder if any of the panelists can explain why Title IX isn't more effective in promoting gender equity in areas other than sports. Specifically, I'm thinking of technology and engineering, where women still comprise less than 20% of the degrees awarded. Has anyone looked into equal access issues with regards to gender and technology education? Can you help us, Welch Suggs?
Yes, that's actually the topic of my dissertation, more or less. And the numbers are a little bit low. The number of women who are majoring in the STEM majors, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, is growing, and is still growing. At a pretty substantial clip. But the interesting part is, and this ties in with the discussion we were just having, is that athletics is really the only or one of the very few areas of education where we accept sex segregation. And this is an artifact of a decision that was made in the 1960s to make men's NCAA teams for men only and women's teams under the women's organizations for women only. This was thought at the time to be a positive move in terms of allowing women their own space to develop and to develop more people. But the difference is that in engineering, there is no, you know, de facto reason for sex segregation. And so in theory, the majors, any academic major, is open to both male and female students. And, of course, there are issues behind that that we need to look at very closely about why there aren't more women in certain areas. But what you see is over time, the percentages are creeping up, and you are seeing women disperse more among different academic fields.
I'm going to go to another listener's email. This is from Kenji, and Deborah Rohde might get a response from you on this. Kenji, what is the theoretical basis for proportionality in Title IX? Is it that women's interest and desire to participate in sports is the same as men? Is there any evidence for this?
Well, the premise of Title IX enforcement is that institutions don't have to meet rigid quotas. They don't have to have exactly the same opportunities as long as they show that they are fully and effectively accommodating the interests and abilities of women or the sex that is not participating at equal levels. So I think it's a kind of notion of substantive equality rather than formal equality. That is, you don't have to have exact parity between the number of women enrolled in the school and the number of women athletes, but what you do have to make sure of is that you have adequate opportunities for all the interested women to participate.
And let me try to get another quick call on here. Elizabeth, that's you. Good morning.
Good Good morning. This is Elizabeth Kristen. I'm a lawyer at the Legal Aid Society of San Francisco Employment Law Center. And I just wanted to comment on Title IX athletic opportunities in high schools. We've brought two class action lawsuits against high schools here in California where we had girls interested and able, willing to participate in sports, and yet the schools were treating them as second-class citizens, particularly around softball, building brand new fields for boys' baseball, and yet giving the girls dilapidated, inferior fields. And so I was wondering if the panel could comment on the applicability in high school, and especially around the issue that sports is so important for the development of high school girls later in life, not just those who go on to become elite college athletes.
Well, let's get a quick comment from Ann Killian.
Well, I think that high school is still kind of the uncharted territory in Title IX. I think that there's a lot more watchdog and vigilance at the college level. And high school, there's so many high schools of so many different sizes. And girls, let's face it, maybe are not as assertive in claiming their rights. And maybe their parents aren't as educated at that level. So I really think there's a lot that needs to be done at the high school level. And I hear little horror stories here and there, you know, throughout all the time. That are, you know, perhaps small injustices, but you add them all together and there's a big problem out there.
Well, lots of problems, and we hope solutions on the road. Again, Stanford University this Saturday, Stanford University Center of Ethics hosting a day-long conference on Title IX, followed by an Aurora Forum and the Maples Pavilion featuring Billie Jean King. I want to thank Brandi Chastain, a gold medal List, who joined us earlier. Also thank Myra Strober, professor of education at Stanford, and Deborah Rohde, Edward McFarland, professor of law at Stanford. Her book is Speaking of Sex, The Denial of Gender Inequality. Our thanks also to Welch Suggs, who joined us from Athens, Georgia, author of A Place on the Team, The Triumph and Tragedy of Title IX, and Ann Killian, sports columnist with the San Jose Mercury News. Another hour of Forum coming your way. We're going to talk about migration in the hour ahead in our beginning of an emigration series. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our interns, Lila Rizaki, Christina Shaheen, Claire Liu, and Katie Stanford. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.